Stalin violated the Soviet-Polish non-aggression pact by invading Poland in 1939. Stalin violated the Soviet-Finnish non-aggression pact by invading Finland in 1939 without any declaration of war, starting the Winter War. The heroic Finns fought back the Big Red Army. Stalin bombed Sweden in 1940. Stalin violated a provision of the Soviet-German non-aggression pact, Ribbentrop-Molotov, by invading Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia in 1940. Bolsheviks rolled in to terrorize, torture, and kill the people in the standard communist practice. The Soviet cattle car deportations afflicted more than 500,000 Estonian, Latvian, and Lithuanian Christian Europeans who were shipped to the Gulag. 12% of the entire Baltic population was either deported to Siberia or executed by the Jewish Soviet secret police. Stalin grabbed a piece of eastern Romania in 1940 and forced Romania to surrender Bessarabia, Moldavia. In a sickening double standard, the Allies remained silent about this brutal Soviet aggression. Instead, the Churchill-Stalin Pact was signed on 15th of October 1939. Secretary of State for War Churchill signed the executive documents of this pact on 8th of February 1940 in London. The Allies did not give a rat's ass about Poland. They only used her to start the war against Germany. And now? Still no boycotts and no war declarations on Soviet. No anti-communist propaganda in the media. And no, Stalin is the warmonger. Nothing. Since 1933, when he befriended the Soviets, Roosevelt had consistently maintained close relations with people who were either communists or communist sympathizers. Hitler was well aware that Stalin was on his way to invade Europe. His suspicions about Stalin have since the fall of Soviet been proven as being legitimate. Document number 103202/06, signed Chief of Staff Kirill Meretsko in 1940, revealed that Stalin was preparing to invade Western Europe in July 1941 in a massive invasion called Operacja Grossa, Operation Thunderstorm. It is dated 18th of September 1940, 3 months before the German Operation Barbarossa was signed. After Georgi Sukov became chief of the General Staff in February 1941, the plan was called MP41, Mobilizzazione Plan 41. It can be found in the so-called Osobaya Papka, a file which contains about 100,000 top-secret documents. In the book Ledokol, or Icebreaker, Russian Jewish historian Viktor Suvorov gives us compelling proof that Hitler was forced into a preemptive strike against a massive Soviet military machine ready to invade and destroy the whole of Western Europe. Suvorov quotes top-secret Soviet documents which proves that the Soviet army was entirely built as an offensive force. Stalin was using the classical divide-and-conquer strategy. He was first hoping for Britain, France, and Germany to be exposed, destroyed, and exhausted so that the Red Army would be able to invade their territory in the West. All Bolshevik preparations were for invasion, not defense. The Soviet Union had already moved division after division closer to the German border. It was producing 5 to 10 times the number of tanks, machine guns, cannons, and airplanes that Germany was able to produce. For every month that passed by, Germany's odds got worse. Given the communists' openly stated ambition of conquering the world, there could not have been any doubt that Stalin was ready for an assault on Germany. In 1941, Admiral N.G. Kuznetsov was a Soviet Navy minister, as well as a member of the Central Committee of the Soviet Communist Party. In his post-war memoirs, he recalled, "For me, there is one thing beyond all argument. Stalin not only did not exclude the possibility of war with Hitler's Germany, on the contrary, he considered such a war inevitable. Stalin made preparations for war, wide and varied preparations, beginning on dates which he himself had selected. Hitler upset his calculations. German Italians had learned of the planned Soviet attack on Europe and prepared the counterplan, Operation Barbarossa. On 22nd of June 1941, Hitler invaded Soviet in a preemptive attack. This German preemptive strike saved Europe from the Red Army, at least for a while. Stalin was about to strike Western Europe with 3 million soldiers when getting caught with their pants down as German soldiers carried belt buckles engraved with the words "God mit uns," God with us, entered their now anti-Christian Red Land. From the Baltic to the Black Sea, German soldiers were getting into positions to launch the invasion. The most brutal battles in recorded history took place along the Eastern Front, which stretched back to Germany through the Soviet Union, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, the Balkans, Ukraine, Belarus, Poland, and the Baltic states. In these landscapes, Europe's bravest soldiers sacrificed their lives to liberate Europe from the terror of the Bolsheviks. Ukrainians, Russians, Estonians, Latvians, and other Eastern Europeans welcomed the Germans as they were liberated from the slavery and torture previously endured under Soviet hands. Local women blessed the Germans as they passed. Women gave the soldiers food, and the soldiers even helped them restoring homes and churches.
The German villages, what was left of us, was herded into the cattle trains and shipped to Siberia. And quite a few villages really disappeared that way, and it was literally a matter of hours, if not minutes, until our turn in Halbstadt came. And I understand that actually half of Halbstadt was exiled. And we were already sitting at the railroad station, this was September 1941, when the German army overran the Ukraine and stopped the exiling, stopped the trains, they stopped the trains. And it was to us as if the Lord had sent us the angels. Here were people who spoke German, who spoke High German, who stopped the terror that had been upon us for 25 years, who came and opened the churches for us and said, you can have all the services you want. It was like heaven. My mother, to the day she died, never stopped talking about the wonderful 2 years that she had with the German army when the German army came and took over the villages. They moved in on us. They took over the houses. We gave them gladly. They could have. My grandmother started cooking as if cooking went out of fashion. And it was magnificent when the Germans came. And they set up, apparently, certain headquarters there. They had some radio broadcasts, certain stations and so on. But most of them moved, of course, ran over us and moved east in their fight toward Moscow, in their push toward Moscow. But some stayed back. And we were absolutely convinced that the Germans had come to save us from communism. And never was there any reason for us to change our minds. Why should we? The Germans were heroes in our eyes.
As the Germans advanced east, millions of Russians refused to fight for Stalin and instead surrendered to the Germans. Stalin's tyranny was hated by every freedom-loving Russian, so hated in fact that whole formations surrendered and volunteered to fight for the Germans instead, taking back their motherland from the terror of Jewish Bolshevism. Hitler viewed communism as a poison to Europe and decided that his life's purpose was to root out and destroy it. The Germans had nothing against the Russians as people, but instead against communism. Many Russians volunteered to fight for Hitler instead. Nearly 500,000 Russian volunteers served on the front lines, and another 100,000 or more serving in other non-combat positions. The anti-communist soldiers of the Russian Liberation Army wore German uniforms with a Russian patch. In 1944, it was officially renamed the Armed Forces of the Committee for the Liberation of the Peoples of Russia. They were led by General Andrei Vlasov, but under German high command. They fought bravely, primarily in key roles against the communist partisans. General Vlasov and Heinrich Himmler met and ironed out details of the formation of a massive new army composed of Russians. They went over what was called the Smolensk Manifesto, written in 1942, which outlined goals of liberating Russia from the communist occupation. It stipulated that in the new Russia, every people will obtain national freedom, including the right of self-determination.
The realization of this right to national independence and freedom is possible, however, only after destroying Stalin and his clique. Himmler and Vlasov agreed that there will initially be 5 divisions organized from Russian POWs and workers from the occupied eastern territories, whose number by then had reached over 5 million. Hitler also formed the Einsatzgruppen, units for the necessary removal of the bloodthirsty Jewish Bolshevik leadership from the Soviet cities. Criminal communist partisans were executed and hanged as punishment for what they had done to the Christian Russians. Stalin was now rumored to have suffered a breakdown. Adolf Hitler explained, "You probably all felt that this was a bitter and difficult step for me. The German people have never had hostile feelings towards the peoples of Russia. During the last 2 decades, however, the Jewish Bolshevist rulers in Moscow have attempted to set not only Germany, but all of Europe aflame. Germany has never attempted to spread its National Socialist worldview to Russia. Rather, the Jewish Bolshevist rulers in Moscow have constantly attempted to subject us and the other European peoples to their rule. They have attempted this not only intellectually, but above all through military means. The results of their efforts in every nation were only chaos, misery, and starvation." Before the Battle of Moscow, Hitler had succeeded in defeating the Soviet army and taking numerous prisoners. Then, an unbelievable freeze happened, 40 to 50 degrees Celsius below zero. The cold caused problems for the Germans. The German troops had only summer uniforms and equipment was also freezing on the spot. No tanks could move. The weather would intensify and temperatures plummet. Time would decisively turn against the Germans, and before the last push of Wehrmacht into Moscow, Germany was stuck. Meanwhile, Roosevelt extended the Lend-Lease Act, which would send even more financial and military aid to the Soviet Union. $11.3 billion, or around $150 billion today, to save the communist regime. It was at that time the masses of Siberian troops were brought back from the Russian Far East and thrown against the Germans. The Germans did not manage to take Moscow, and were instead pushed back again. Stalin felt the need to have his troops backed by blocking units, tasked to execute anyone retreating from the front. He also branded anyone captured as a traitor, and later executed these former prisoners, while sending their family members to the camps.
You have to remember that when the Red Army marched, behind the Red Army was a second army, the NKVD army, which had its own tanks, its own machine guns and so on, firing forward so that nobody could move back.
Stalin's son, Jacob Shugashvili, was captured by the Wehrmacht in 1942. The Wehrmacht offered to exchange German prisoners with Stalin for the return of his son. Stalin rejected this and stated, "I have no son named Yukov." Although the circumstances are unclear, Yukov later died in captivity. Some say that he ran into a fence surrounding a POW camp. Some say that he was shot when trying to escape. Closing into Stalingrad, Stalin now cowardly fled the city. The Battle of Stalingrad between the Germans and the Soviets was fought for control of the strategically vital Soviet city that Stalin had named after himself, today known as Volgograd. The battle was one of the bloodiest in history, with military and civilian deaths of nearly 2 million. Stalin's refusal to pull the Red Army out of the city led to a long barrier and tremendous amount of suffering for the hungry citizens. In July 1942, Stalin issued an order preventing any civilians, even women and children, from leaving the city. After the German offense captured most of the city, the US Lend-Lease-equipped Red Army destroyed the Germans with bloody house-to-house fighting. The losses suffered by the Germans would make victory in Russia impossible. Germany's war economy was not set to total war mode until 1943, i.e., too late. On February the 2nd, 1943, Field Marshal Friedrich Paulus finally surrendered to the Soviets. 300,000 German Croatian, Hungarian, Romanian, and Italian soldiers, including 35,000 Russian volunteers fighting for Germany against the communists, had now been surrounded. Over 11,000 refused to lay down their weapons at the official surrender, preferring instead to fight until death against the Bolsheviks. By early March, all resistance had been wiped out. Those who remained were forced to march east or work themselves to death in Soviet death camps. Historians have now confirmed that of the 11,237 letters that were sent by soldiers to their families, almost all of them expressed a willingness and determination to fight communism and die fighting for National Socialism and the Führer, Adolf Hitler. The Battle of Stalingrad would be a turning point in the war. After the Battle of Kursk in 5th of July to 23rd of August 1943, the Germans were outnumbered by more than 2-1 and suffered casualties of around 203,000, while the communists lost 803,000. The Germans did not achieve their goal. Germany was forced into a full-scale retreat as the US opened a new front in Italy. Germany would never again regain the initiative in the war. The Germans were steadily forced completely out of Soviet territory, after which the Soviet pursued them across Eastern Europe and into Germany itself in 1945. The Germans would now fight in freezing weather conditions and at the same time offer much needed protection to refugees fleeing the murderous communists. More and more people desperately fled west to reach safety from the communists.
And then, of course, in 1943 the story changed and the Germans were pushed back. And in the pushback, they moved us with them, what was left of us. And we went willingly. There was no moving at gunpoint. Had we stayed back, the communists would have taken us and executed us or shipped us to Siberia. So we very, very willingly moved, retreated with the Germans. You know, here we were walking toward the Reich, toward Germany, which had always been in our minds a fictitious place. We absolutely believed in Adolf Hitler. We believed in the nature of his struggle, in the merits of his struggle. We had these magnificent German soldiers protecting us all the way, and we were walking into the Reich. So there were lots of songs along the way in the beginning, in the fall. There were all these Hitler youth with their beautiful snappy clothing and on bicycles, and they were giving us fresh water, and the BDM girls were cooking and, you know, serving us coffee and so on. We always were fed by the army. They had field kitchens, traveling grim. Then the winter came and food was getting short. The horses were getting sick. The road was getting narrower. It was extremely cold. When I think of the war and of the trek, I do not think of hunger so much as of cold. It was always, always cold. That's what I remember. And then, of course, once the winter came, it became harder and harder. We had to often stay overnight in strange houses. The army would confiscate houses, would put the refugees there. The army protected us to the end. The army never, ever let us down, never let us down to the very end. Keep in mind also that Germany at that time did not need refugees.
That is for sure.
You know, they were starving, they were struggling, they had nothing. They took us in as family.
While the soldiers on the ground were battling to end the war, leading politicians were doing all they could for political reasons to continue the conflict. In October 1940, when Germany was in total control of the European war, there was no chance of British victory unless the US could be dragged into the conflict. A prominent member of the British War Cabinet, Lord Arthur Greenwood, offered the Jews a New World Order in hopes of enlisting their support to bring a reluctant America into the war conflict in the same way it had done in 1917 with the Balfour Declaration that promised Palestine to the Jews in exchange for bringing about US entry. Greenwood made a prophetic statement. When we have achieved victory, and we surely shall, Greenwood promises, in the rebuilding of civilized society after the war, there should and will be a real opportunity for Jews everywhere to make a distinctive and constructive contribution, and that 10 million American boys will be needed to do the job. The U.S. would enter the war 14 months later. Chaim Weizmann said to Churchill in September 1941, "We managed to drag the United States into the First World War, and if they, the U.S., do what we demand in regards to Palestine and the Jewish armed forces, then we can get the Jews in the USA to drag the United States into this one too." Already in 1939, Brigadier General George Van Horn Mosley exposed the plan in the New York Tribune. "The war now proposed is for the purpose of establishing Jewish hegemony throughout the world." Even though the British Empire already had vast resources and millions of men at her disposal, Churchill and Roosevelt would now push for the U.S. to enter the war. Never before in history were the American people as anti-war or as united in their views as they were in 1939 about staying out of what they saw as yet another European civil war. The Gallup poll showed 94% of the American people was absolutely against participation in the war when it began in September 1939. The ordinary people were tired of these wars. Despite this fact, Roosevelt forced laws through Congress contradicting U.S. supposed neutrality. In 1939, Roosevelt repealed the U.S. Neutrality Act in favor of a one-sided supply of arms to Germany's enemies. The year after, Roosevelt passed the Lend-Lease Act, which officially ended his pretense of being neutral in the war. He also allowed American citizens to join the British Air Force. In a violation of international law, Roosevelt proceeded to freezing all German assets in the U.S. and announced an oil embargo against aggressor nations. $1 billion in Lend-Lease aid was sent to Britain. Benjamin Gitlow, founding member of the U.S. Communist Party, wrote in I Confess in 1940, "When I was in Moscow, the attitude toward the United States in the event of war was discussed. Privately, I was the opinion of all the Russian leaders to whom I spoke that the rivalry between the United States and Japan must actually break out into war between these two." Because Roosevelt was well aware of the amount of popular feeling on this issue, he would repeatedly lie to the American people about his love of peace and his determination to keep the U.S. out of war, while simultaneously actually doing everything in his power to take both Europe and America into war. As with the case of Germany, Japan had also broken the shackles of Rothschild's interest and experienced an economic miracle and a national rebirth. It could not be allowed. Japan had to be taken out to become a milking cow of the bankers again. On 23rd of June 1941, United States Interior Secretary Harold LeClaire Ickes wrote in a memo to Roosevelt, "There will never be so good a time to stop the shipment of oil to Japan as we now have. There might develop from the embargoing of oil to Japan such a situation as would make it not only possible but easy to get into this war in an effective way. And if we should thus indirectly be brought in, we would avoid the criticism that we had gone in as an ally of communist Russia." Roosevelt was of course still looking desperately for a way to enter the war. He then froze all Japanese assets in the US and later forced an oil embargo on Japan in an international act of hostility. As a direct result, Japan now lost access to 75% of her overseas trade and 88% of her imported oil. This led to Japan now having insufficient resources to continuing her war with China. To avoid war, the Japanese first entered into negotiations with US officials, who demanded that Japan first would withdraw from China before any embargoes would end. Roosevelt, of course, knew that the Japanese never would let themselves be humiliated in such a way. If the Japanese refused it, the embargo would continue and they would collapse from economic strangulation. If they complied and withdrew all troops from the mainland, communism would sweep Eastern Asia, exactly as happened after the war, resulting in communist China and the Korean and Vietnam Wars. The Japanese were giving a two-headed coin: die by starvation or die by communism. They decided to reject both of these options and fight instead. War Secretary Henry Stimson phrased it in his diary, "We faced a delicate question of the diplomatic fencing to be done so as to be sure that Japan is put into the wrong and makes the first bad move, overt move. The question was how we should maneuver the Japanese into the position of firing the first shot." The major organization which propagated up public support for US involvement in the European war before the Pearl Harbor attack was the cleverly named Committee to Defend America by Aiding the Allies. At the end of 1940, West Virginia Senator Rush D. Holt issued a detailed examination of the committee. The committee has powerful connections with banks, insurance companies, financial investing firms, and industrial concerns. These in turn exert influence on college presidents and professors, as well as on newspapers, radio, and other means of communication. If the committee succeeded in getting the US into war, Holt warned, American boys will spill their blood for profiteers, politicians, and patriots. If war comes on the hands of the sponsors of the White Committee, will be blood, the blood of Americans killed in a needless war. In March 1941, a list of most of the committee's financial backers was made public. It revealed the forces eager to bring America into the European war. Powerful international, primarily Jewish banking interests were well represented. In his diary entry of the 1st of May 1941, Charles A. Lindbergh, the American heroic aviator and peace leader, exposed the coalition that was pushing the United States into the war. "The pressure for war is high and mounting. The people are opposed to it, but the administration seems to have the bit in its teeth and is hell-bent on its way to war. Most of the Jewish interests in the country are behind war, and they control a huge part of our press and radio, and most of our motion pictures." Dr. Milton Eisenhower was General Eisenhower's brother. He said, "President Roosevelt found it necessary to get the country into World War II to save his social policies." Early in 1941, Congressman Martin Diaz's committee came into possession of a strategic map which gave clear proof of the intentions of the Japanese to make an assault on Pearl Harbor. The strategic map was prepared by the Japanese Imperial Military Intelligence Department. Martin wrote, "As soon as I received the document, I telephoned Secretary of State Coral Holt and told him what I had. Secretary Holt directed me not to let anyone know about the map and stated that he would call me as soon as he talked to President Roosevelt. In about an hour, he telephoned to say that he had talked to Roosevelt and they agreed that it would be very serious if any information concerning this map reached the news services. I told him it was a grave responsibility to withhold such vital information from the public. The secretary assured me that he and Roosevelt considered it essential to national defense." General Elliot R. Thorps served as a military attache in Dutch-controlled Java, Netherlands Indies, in 1941, when the Dutch broke a Japanese diplomatic code. The intercepted message referred to planned Japanese attacks on Hawaii, the Philippines, and Thailand. He immediately cabled the information to Washington and promptly delivered copies of the decoded text to including President Roosevelt, Secretary of State Cordell Hull, Secretary of War Henry Stimson, Army Chief of Staff General George Marshall, and the Chief of Naval Operations Admiral Harold Stark. Copies also went to Harry Hopkins, FDR's communist advisor. Because the US and Britain now had cracked Japan's naval communication codes, all important Japanese codes were broken. Roosevelt knew about the coming surprise attack, but no warning was sent to the commanders at Pearl Harbor. Naval intelligence intercepted and translated numerous Japanese naval dispatches, some clearly revealing that Pearl Harbor had been targeted. If a break in the US relations was forthcoming, Tokyo would issue a special radio warning. The message to be repeated 3 times during a weather report was Higashi no kaze ame, east wind rain. East wind signified the United States. Rain signified diplomatic split, a war. This prospective message was deemed so significant that US radio monitors were constantly watching for it, and the Navy Department typed it up on special reminder cards. On December 4th, Higashi no Kaze Ame was broadcast and picked up by Washington intelligence. While issuing the final provocations of Japan, FDR and his military chairman George Marshall set the bait for the Japanese fish to bite. The Japanese, in the hopes of gaining an early advantage, decided to impose as much danger to the US Navy as possible. On the morning of 7th of December 1941, Japanese planes, launched from aircraft carriers, attacked the American fleet at Pearl Harbor in Hawaii, sinking or heavily damaging 18 ships, including 8 battleships, destroying 188 planes. The attack on Pearl Harbor ignited a sudden press frenzy and a wave of patriotic enthusiasm for entering the war. Roosevelt and the people around him would finally have their world war. The attack was not a surprise. Roosevelt deliberately allowed 2,400 US sailors to die without any warning. From the diary of Henry Stimson, we can see that Stimson's immediate feeling was not one of sorrow or outraged over the lost lives at Pearl Harbor, but rather of relief. When the news first came that Japan had attacked us, my first feeling was of relief that a crisis had come. Oliver Littleton, wartime British production manager, was undeniably correct when he declared, "It is a travesty on history ever to say that the United States was forced into the war. America provoked the Japanese to such an extent they were forced to attack." The text of Hirohito's war declaration appeared once in the New York Times before its allegation disappeared in the winner's official history. "We hereby declare war upon the United States of America and the British Empire to ensure the stability of East Asia and to contribute to world peace, to cultivate friendship among nations, and to enjoy prosperity in common with all nations, has always been the guiding principle of our empire's foreign policy. It has truly been unavoidable and far from our wishes that our empire has been brought to crossroads with America and Britain." Hamilton Fish made the first speech in Congress on 8th of September 1941, asking for a declaration of war against Japan. In his book, FDR, The Other Side of the Coin, Fish says he is ashamed of that speech today, and if he had known what Roosevelt had been doing to provoke Japan to attack, he would never have asked for a declaration of war. Fish said Roosevelt was the main firebrand to light the fuse of war both in Europe and the Pacific. In 1943, when Japan occupied the important rice exporter Burma, the British bought up massive amounts of rice and hoarded it. Churchill then ordered the diversion of food away from India in order to feed his own troops instead. Now a rare commodity, the price of rice went up fourfold. The wheat from Australia, which could have been delivered to starving Indians before, was instead transported to British troops. Even worse, British colonial authorities, again under Churchill's leadership, actually refused offers from Canada and the United States to ship free food to the starving country. Churchill intentionally starved more than 4 million innocent Bengalis to death to pump resources into the war against the Axis powers. Churchill hated Indians almost as much as he hated Germans, because India wanted its independence from Britain. Gandhi was also very positive to Hitler. Later, at a war cabinet meeting, Churchill blamed the Indians themselves for the famine, saying that they breed like rabbits. These victims were not Jewish, and that's why you never hear about them. Churchill did not even try to hide the fact that he hated Indians and Germans. "I hate Indians. They are beastly people." He also said that Gandhi ought to be lain bound hand and foot at the gates of Delhi, and then trampled on by an enormous elephant with the new viceroy seated on its back. Churchill's colorful commentary may have been a product of his terminal alcohol addiction, or just his overall antisocial impulsivity. What makes it all a bigger tragedy is that the victims have never been compensated, and the person responsible for the famine has never even been held responsible. Instead, he has been celebrated as a hero. The soft underbelly of Europe was left vulnerable to an attack, and the oil fields of Romania fueled the German military. Hitler worried that the Allies would invade Yugoslavia, Greece, and the Balkan nations to cut off Germany's oil supply and launch a final push upon Germany from the south and southeast. Such an attack would be disastrous and detrimental to Germany, but instead of just taking this opportunity to put an end to the war, Churchill, Dwight Eisenhower, Montgomery, and George Marshall instead insisted upon making preparations for an invasion of heavily fortified northern France instead, to prolong the war, kill more Europeans, and buy the Soviets much-needed time to march westward, and eventually enable Stalin to take the whole of Eastern Europe as they had agreed. The reason for this was that Roosevelt and Henry Morgenthau envisioned a post-war world in which the Soviets and the United States would join forces to lay the foundations for a communist international world government, the UN. At the sixth hour of the sixth day of the sixth month of 1944, British, American, and Canadian forces crossed the English Channel and launched a D-Day invasion, landing in German-occupied France via the coast of Normandy. Roosevelt and Churchill had for years provided the Soviet Union with military and financial aid. Now they would finally send in their troops to fight and die for communism. Nearly 10,000 men were killed storming Hitler's fortified beaches of Normandy. In the end, Overlord successfully established an initial beachhead of 100,000 troops. From this base in northern France, the Allies were reinforced for the push towards Germany. At the same time, the Red Terror advanced from the east, equipped to the teeth with advanced American aid from Roosevelt. With Italy also under Allied occupation, Germany now had three fronts to defend: west, south, and east. In order to intentionally give the communists even more time to conquer and rape Eastern Europe, General Eisenhower and Marshall delayed the advance of General Patton's Third Army, going so far as to cut off shipments of gasoline to Patton's army. Patton said in August 1944, "At the present time, our chief difficulty is not the Germans, but gasoline. If they would give me enough gas, I could go all the way to Berlin." Between December 1944 and January 1945, the German forces made a last desperate effort to drive back the Allied forces, which took the Allies completely by surprise and almost turned the war on its head. fought in the forest around the mountain region of Belgium, the mighty German offensive would be known as the Battle of the Bulge. American forces were met with German panzer divisions in the Ardennes forest battling the frigid weather as they fought each other. It was a decisive moment in World War II which would give Hitler a last chance to drive back the approaching Allied armies to the coastline. His wish was to force them back again to a negotiated peace. A quarter of a million German soldiers rolled towards the Western Front and moved their units in secret towards points east of Ardennes in late October. The Allies underestimated the Germans and thought they did not have the military strength for such an attack. In December, would the Germans advance and surround Bastogne, then drive the Meuse River? American troops discovered German troops in front and behind them. Thousands of Allied soldiers destroyed their weapons and gave up in one of the largest surrenders in military history. The ammunition was short as battalions were down to 10 rounds per gun, and the weather conditions were still cold and snowy. The freezing cold conditions did not make it easy for any side in the battles. Frostbite was rampant, and the bitter cold caused additional casualties. The Germans floating to encircle the Allies in Bastogne from all sides. If they wanted, the Germans could now have easily taken Bastogne, but instead they gave the Americans an ultimatum of an honorable surrender. The Allies would have none of it. Allied planes instead arrived and started strafing and bombing the Germans and dropping supplies to the Allies, enough to make the Americans turn the tide. On January 3rd, the Allies launched a counterattack. And on January 16th, patrols from the 1st and 3rd armies met north of Bastogne and pushed back the Germans again. By early February, the Germans had been pushed back where they started again. At the same time, the Soviets had taken the vital oil fields in the east, which caused lack of fuel for the German tanks in the west. This lack of fuel prevented them from reaching the Meuse River and left the Luftwaffe permanently stranded. German losses exhausted the last reserves and mounted at 84,834. The remaining German forces would now be driven back to their retreat in Berlin. The Battle of the Bulge was also the bloodiest battle US forces fought in the war, which resulted in 19,000 dead, 47,000 wounded, and 23,000 captured. Winston Churchill appointed the Jewish professor Lindemann as his personal advisor. Lindemann, together with Churchill, decided that Germany would be subjected to area, carpet, saturation, unrestricted bombing, or what the victims themselves called terror bombing. Lindemann suggested the bombing of German cities and that working-class civilian areas were legitimate targets. These bombings began on 10th of August 1940 with the bombing of the small town of Freiburg. This was before the Germans began bombing British cities. The goal of the bombings was to break the spirit of the Germans. Between 1940 and 1945, 61 German cities with a total population of 25 million souls were destroyed in the bombing campaigns by the Allies. The Allies specifically targeted innocent civilians. Many large cities such as Cologne and Essen experienced more than 250 raids each. Churchill's deliberate strategy was killing as many German civilians as possible. Perhaps the next time round the way to do it will be to kill women, children and the civilian population, Churchill explained. In 1943, when the US finally had rearmed the British, the civilization that the Germans had fought fiercely for was now surrounded from every single angle. Each plane heading for Germany was loaded with tons of high explosives and incendiary bombs. Over the cities, the Americans strategically bombed industrial plants during the day, while the British purposely targeted innocent civilians at night, aiming at houses of the working-class communities. The plan was to inflict as much damage, to destroy as many homes, and to kill as many women, children, and elderly as possible. Churchill wanted more than two cities a month demolished until none would be left. Bomber Harris championed the bombing of cities. The city he was most focused on was Berlin. In documents from Operation Thunderclap, he stated that he wanted the total devastation of the center of Berlin. More bombs by weight would be dropped on the city of Berlin than on the whole of Great Britain during the entire war. German cities will be subjected to an ordeal, the like of which has never been experienced by a country in continuity, severity, and magnitude. To achieve this end, there are no length of violence to which we will not go. Guaranteed Winston Churchill. As swarms of British bombers began a systematic destruction of Germany, tons of high explosives were unleashed on the nation, as schools, hospitals, homes, beautiful ancient art and architecture were all obliterated. The Allies thought that this would lower German morale on both the home and battle fronts, to the point that absolute collapse was inevitable for the Third Reich. In the horrific war crimes instigated by Churchill and Arthur Bomber Harris, hundreds of thousands of German civilians would now be burned alive in consequential firestorms in German cities. Many of these raids consisted of initial attacks using high explosive bombs to break up buildings, followed with attacks using thousands of incendiary bombs to set alight all the fabrics, furnishing, and upholstery exposed by the explosives. In this way, firestorms were created under the right conditions, which burned tens of thousands of people alive, especially the women and children at home, while the men were at the front. The first explosive bombs blasted the roofs of buildings in preparation for incendiary devices, knocking out the air raid warning systems and causing massive destruction and death. Fire halls and water mains were also completely destroyed. When the roaring bombers released their lethal cargo, a crescendo of fire descended on the cities. Dresden was turned into an ocean of fire. Air temperatures rose to 600 degrees Celsius, winds up to 45 meters per second, sucked all oxygen into the center of the storm. Hundreds of thousands of people were burned alive. A RAF crewman said, "There were people down there being fried to death in melted asphalt on the roads. They were being burnt up, and we were shuffling incendiary bombs into this holocaust. I felt terribly sorry for the people in that fire I was helping to stoke up."
It was evil. Thousands of firebombs dropping all over the place, explosions, heat, fire, people screaming, people burning, people alight. Well, it wasn't. After about half an hour, it started developing into something which was really bad. Lot came over and dropped all these incendiaries. And then, of course, as wave after wave came over, the impact got heavier. 35 minutes, 40 minutes after the first bombs had dropped, the bomb dropped outside the building that we was in, killed my mate, Harry, and about three quarters of the people in there were killed. And so you go out and you come out of there and the whole place is a furnace. It's a furnace. Because we were in the centre of Dresden. It was the second wave which really brought the tornado into being. Because then they started dropping the 4,000 pound blockbusters, 4,000 pounds of napalm, which if he dropped anything within about 300 yards was immediately incinerated to feed the fire, so you get the wind coming in. That's really tornado force, and you just can't. It dehumanises everything, anything that you've experienced before. They try to cross over to us, a group of them, and the first lot of them got stuck in the middle of it. They couldn't get away. And in the end, they caught a light. They were still alive. And then they exploded.
Wave upon wave of phosphorus and incendiary bombs washed over the defenseless civilian German population. Thousands of German elderly, women, and children suffocated or was burned alive in basements and tunnels where they were hiding, as the oxygen was sucked out of their hiding places and pulled toward the blaze to feed the flames. Thousands more were hurtled into the air and sucked by the winds right into the fire. Some perished in a blast of white heat intense enough to melt the human flesh. Wherever there was a water fountain or canal, the city's inhabitants jumped in only to be boiled alive. The attacks left the cities a raging sea of fire, hundreds of smaller fires merging into single huge conflagrations. Huge masses of air were then sucked in to feed the inferno, causing an artificial tornado. The firestorm in Dresden was so massive that pilots reported that their cockpits actually were illuminated by the great fire. The air suction of the fire was so powerful that it uprooted trees and lifted roofs from houses miles away. Total panic struck the people.
Da kam so wuchtig, dass dann eben alles weg war. Die Menschen, die sind ja gerannt wie die Wahnsinnigen. Ringsrum brannte es. Es brannte nur alles, alles.
Die Stadt brannte, das war ein Feuerschein und Dunkelheit und Feuerschein zugleich. Das ist überhaupt nicht zu beschreiben. Ne? Ganz grausam.
Die Frau mit ihrer Tochter, die ist mit verbrannt. Meine Schwester, die hat im Nebenhaus gewohnt. Dort haben aber vielleicht 20 Kinder mit drinnen gewohnt in dem Haus. Die sind alle verbrannt. Am lebenden Leib verbrannt.
Achtung, Achtung! Hier ist der Befehlstand der 1. Flakdivision Berlin. Die gemeldeten Bomberverbände befinden sich im Raum Hannover-Braunschweig. Wir kommen wieder.
I went down on my knees, trembled, and cried. Several women lay there with their bellies burst open, and one could see the babies, for they were hanging half outside. Many of the babies were mutilated. Scenes like that one I saw everywhere, and very slowly one became numbed. One acted like a zombie.
Some found missing loved ones. Most, however, did not.
War und ich auf die Straße ging, dem Feuersturm entgegen, da sah ich tote Menschen, nackt. Ich dachte, warum sind die nackt? Die haben an den Kleidern gebrannt und haben sich die Kleider vom Leibe gerissen. Ich habe nie so viele Tote gesehen wie nach diesem Angriff.
Es war furchtbar, es war furchtbar. Meine Tochter am Sachsenplatz, da sind wir die Stufen hoch und da lagen die Leichen. Nur die Körper. Und da fragte mich meine Tochter, Mami, was ist denn das, was hier liegt? Ich sage, komm, guck dir's nicht an. Das sind alles Leichen.
Man war vollkommen sinnlos und schwer zu beschreiben. Und jedenfalls kommt mir dort im Dunkeln ein Mann entgegen, sehe ich plötzlich eine Gestalt auf mich zukommen von Klein Scharwitzer Ufer her. Und da bleibt er stehen, hat einen Handkoffer in der Hand und lacht ganz laut und ganz irre. Es war unheimlich. Ich habe gedacht, der Teufel steht auf der Erde. Und da sagt er plötzlich, wir Polen und Tschechen, wir haben gewusst. Und morgen kommt noch ein Angriff. Ne? Also ich war so entsetzt auf der Anblick von der Stadt und dann dieser Mensch. Ich stand da, ich war von Entsetzen geschüttelt.
After first having blasted the targeted towns to splinters, the British and American bombers soon returned to strafe terrified groups of refugees and rescuers as they tried to escape. The Allies lured the civilians from their shelters into the open again. As they thought it was all over, twice as many bombers returned with massive loads of incendiary bombs and ignited all that remained and spread raging firestorms to the places where refugee Germans had fled. U.S. Mustangs appeared low over the cities, strafing anything that moved, including columns of rescue vehicles and animals. The low-flying Mustangs machine-gunned helpless patients as well as thousands of old men, women, and children, everyone who had escaped the city. When the last plane had left the sky, the cities were left in ruins. The streets were filled with rats swarming over piles of corpses. People had been liquefied into a yellowed mass that melted into the asphalt of the road, and some were left in ashes. Millions of refugees fled the cities, taking with them stories of the most terrible horror they had ever witnessed.
Bin ich weiter, da war ich plötzlich alleine. Alles verstreute sich. Und da bin ich auf der Elbwiese, dann habe ich mich umgesehen. Das erste Mal umgesehen. Und dort habe ich geweint um Dresden, geheult. Geheult um meine Stadt.
The RAF's relentless campaign against Germany during the final months of the war was a massive war crime, which served absolute no military purpose. The worst of all the raids was the one unleashed on Dresden. It had no strategical or tactical gain in the war whatsoever for the Allies. Dresden had no military bases, no communication centers or heavy industry, and no air defense. It was known as a showplace for culture and one of the most beautiful cities in Germany. This Allied air raid left 24,866 homes destroyed, 11 square miles of prime real estate and irreplaceable cultural treasures totally devastated, 35,000 recognizable corpses available to be identified, and hundreds of thousands of unrecognizable ones. More than three-fifths of Dresden was completely destroyed by bombing raids that lasted more than 14 hours. Because of so many refugees fleeing eastward resided in Dresden, it is difficult to say exactly how many were killed. Most honest revisionists estimate the death toll to range from a total of 350,000 to 600,000 dead.
It was called terror bombing among the Germans. I think even some of the RAF British pilots and the Americans also knew it as terror bombing. They weren't kidding themselves. They knew what they were doing. They were slaughtering women and children down below in the German cities. This was sanctified. It was sanctioned by the British and American governments, this deliberate attempt to kill as many people as possible, a deliberate attempt to scorch from the face of the earth every German city above a certain size, let's say 25,000 people. We've all heard of Dresden. If we haven't, we should have heard of Dresden. But what most people don't know is that almost every German city suffered a similar fate. That is terrible, devastating bombing, and then a firestorm that's created by dropping phosphorus bombs to ignite the rubble that's blown this town to bits.
Nothing prepared me for seeing women and children alight and flying through the air. Nothing prepared me for that. After Dresden, I was a nutcase. It took me 40 years to get over it. I don't think I even laughed for 40 years. I couldn't even laugh at anything. I said, and I still say, and I've said it in print, and I've said it in... I'll never forgive the people who ordered those raids. And that goes for all of them. Churchill, Attlee, all of them. Whatever they can say. They were still carrying on bombing other cities like this. And then, of course, they tried to put the blame on somebody else. No, we were supposed to be the good guys, and we finished up being worse than they were. What annoys me is all this was done in our name.
The terror bombings of Germany during World War II left about 3 million Germans dead, 500,000 of them children, up to 10 million wounded, and 25 million homeless.